Welcome to the weekend edition of the Daily Stoic. Each weekday, we bring you a meditation inspired by the ancient Stoics, something to help you live up to those four Stoic virtues of courage, justice, temperance, and wisdom. And then here on the weekend, we take a deeper dive into those same topics. We interview Stoic philosophers. We explore at length how these Stoic ideas can be applied to our actual lives and the challenging issues of our time. Here on the weekend, when you have a little bit more space, when things have slowed down, be sure to take some time to think, to go for a walk, to sit with your journal, and most importantly, to prepare for what the week ahead may bring. The Daily Stoic is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. One of the cool things about podcasts is that you can multitask while you're listening, but depending on what you're doing right now, like for instance, if you're not in some kind of moving vehicle, there's something else you could be doing. You could be getting an auto quote from Progressive Insurance. It's easy and you could save money by doing it right from your phone. Drivers who save by switching to Progressive save nearly $700 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts, discounts for having multiple vehicles on your policy, being a homeowner, and more. So just like your favorite podcast, Progressive will be with you 24/7, 365 days a year, so you're protected no matter what. Multitask right now. Quote your car insurance at progressive.com to join over 29 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $698 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations. Now your ideas don't have to wait. Now they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business and evolving your passions. We push what technology can do so great ideas can happen now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to now. Be that word our sign of parting, bird or fiend, I shrieked upstarting. Get thee back into the tempest and the night's Plutonian shore. Leave no black plume as a token of that lie thy soul hath spoken. Leave my loneliness unbroken. Quit the bust above my door. Take thy beak from out my heart and take thy form from off my door, quoth the raven, nevermore. And the raven, never flitting, still is sitting on the pallid bust of Pallas just above my chamber door. And his eyes have all the seeming of a demon's that is dreaming. And the lamplight o'er him streaming throws his shadow on the floor. And my soul from out that shadow that lies floating on the floor shall be lifted never more. Hey, it's Ryan. Welcome to another episode of the Daily Stoic Podcast. You hopefully, maybe, just a quiver of recognition of those last two stanzas of Edgar Allan Poe's The Raven, which is what I'm going to be talking about a little bit in today's episode. My guest, Catherine, or Kat Babb Majera, is the author of a really funny, awesome, illustrative new book called Poe for Your Problems: Uncommon Advice from History's Least Likely Self-Help Guru, Edgar Allan Poe. It's a fascinating book. It draws on Poe's work and life, what he can teach us both to do and not to do. You might have heard his life was a bit of a mess, and how we can use like the tough situations, the tough breaks, the bad luck, all the things that Poe experienced, all the things we all experience, to make great work and to hopefully carve out an interesting life for ourselves. Kat is a great writer. She's written everywhere from Slate, Quartz, CNBC, NBC News. She's appeared on NPR and many, many other places. She has an MA in creative writing from the University of Auckland, New Zealand. She lives in Richmond, Virginia with her husband and a new baby. I really like this book. I almost never blur books. I have a rule against it. This was a place I made an exception for a friend. I said that books about people's successes are common. Books where you can learn from someone's painful demons and failures are rare. but far more meaningful. And this writing on Poe is insightful, funny, and important. It was a fun book to read. It was a fun conversation to have. And my first interactions with Poe go back to, I remember reading the Great Illustrated Classics as a kid, and they had a collection of Poe's stories. And I remember, as we talk about in the thing, in the interview, the story of the guy they seal up in the wall. But I think the one that haunted me the most was The Telltale Heart. Poe was just a complete master of the short story and of the poem. I personally like Ambrose Bierce a little bit better, slightly, I guess, more modern than and feels accessible than Poe. But nerding out, but going through this book gave me a deeper appreciation of Poe. And then, of course, nerding out about it on this episode was great. Click the show notes for her homepage, follow her on Instagram and Twitter, sign up for her email list. And of course, check out her new book, Poe for Your Problems, and enjoy this interview. I saw this funny meme the other day that was, it was like this hole in a brick wall. And it was saying like, we need someone to help us like find out what's back here. And it was like, you must be small, willing to get dirty, and not have read the story, The Cask of Amontillado.
Right.
I thought it was so funny. And I thought it was funny just that like, how many writers from that era can people make memes about that most people would get?
Right. I mean, the sheer amount of Tumblr posts about Poe, unreal. I remember Vox doing a story on the Cask of Amontillado memes a couple of years ago.
And what, like, why did he cross over? Like, I mean, I guess maybe there's like some Moby Dick jokes or whatever, but like, almost no writers crossed over the way that Poe has crossed over, nor had the staying power that he's had.
That's true. And it's hardly the case that he was the only person writing Gothic short fiction. It was a very popular form, especially in the decades before he came along. So he grew up reading it, but then as an adult sort of perfected it to the point where that's a big question, but I think the psychological insight, the amount of levels that are in a single story and the way that you can, like a child can read them and academics are kept busy by them. And the fact that one writer is able to do both those things, I don't know. I think it probably comes down to the psychological insight of the stories. There's also like a great vein of humor in Poe that people just don't tend to talk about too much.
Is it that he's actually a genius, or is it like a freak of circumstances that, like, I don't know, like nobody looks at E.L. James and goes like the 50 Shades of Grey is so good because it's such a work of genius. We sort of, it's weird, right? Like sometimes when something is very popular, we use that as an indicator that the creator is not particularly talented and that the work is not of particular significance or seriousness. And then it's like, if they're popular over a really long period of time, then the exact opposite is true.
Yeah, people call Poe a bad writer. It's, I mean, all the time, a lot of academics have that opinion of him. And it's not that he wrote some bad stuff. Some of his sentences just make you wince. But when he was good, he was really good. I don't think he was just the E.L. James of his era that ended up getting so much publicity. In a way, you could almost say that it's kind of the case that as a writer, his books ended up getting a ton of promo beyond his reputation in his own era, just because of the controversy that resulted almost immediately from his death that continues to this day. So in a way, he has benefited from that, but I don't think you could have had an empty product to begin with that could have had that kind of staying power.
Yeah, and he wasn't super appreciated in his own time, right? It's not like Agatha Christie or E.L. James where you're like wildly successful in your own life and then sort of like as the years pass, the shine wears off. With the Melvilles and the Poes and, you know, other writers, it's more of a, like, we're almost making up for their lack of appreciation. And so the popularity isn't a fad. It's probably more a result of, like, sustained appreciation for the quality of the work.
I think that's true. I mean, he wasn't really a book writer. in his own time, but he didn't have a single book go into a second edition except for this one about seashells that was essentially a scam and wasn't his real creative work.
So how does someone deal with being massively underappreciated? That would, like, that feels like it would crush a lesser person, right? You work so hard on something. I mean, you're just going through this, not at this scale. I'm not saying your book's a failure. What I'm saying is, like, you put so much into a creative work or a company or a business or a play or, you know, whatever the thing you do is. And then even though you know it's really good, people are like, meh. You know, how does that not crush a person?
Right. I mean, I think this is where you kind of come into, like, the perverse lesson of Poe's life, and that having a gigantic ego that almost can't be reached from the outside can be useful. Because if Poe had been sensitive to criticism, he would have given up. He, you know, would have just crawled in a sewer line or something. But he was impervious to it to a very great degree, an almost pathological degree. Convinced of the greatness of his own work. And he wasn't wrong either. So while this could have bad manifestations, you could have someone with an utterly impervious ego who was producing bad work. This was the rare circumstance where the work was both great and the ego was strong enough to give him the wherewithal and fortitude to keep going.
Yeah, I remember when I was working in Hollywood, I was talking to this sort of very experienced agent manager type, and he was like, look, the reason ego exists in Hollywood is you have to understand where, like, an actress is at the beginning of her career, which is that they go to audition after audition after audition after audition, meeting after meeting after meeting. And people are like, no, no, you're not good enough. You're not this. They're just hearing no all the time. And somehow they have to leave each one of these meetings convinced the world wants to hear my name. So it's this paradox of, like, the mechanism that allows you to succeed in this irrational, insane, often wrong industry is also, like, a nightmarish set of personality traits.
right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it can work for you. I mean, to the extent that I've learned from Poe's life, I'm not a person who comes to the playing field that way. I tend to be very self-questioning and maybe too open to criticism. But picking up just 10% from Poe in that way, it can be enormously useful as a person in any line of creative pursuit.
So how does one get the right balance of it, where you're sort of impervious to the criticism that would make you stop, but then not deaf to the feedback that would make you better?
I mean, I know in my own life, it's like, if my husband tells me something's not working, then I tend to believe him because he knows me and he has my best interests at heart. So maybe it's just listening to the right people. Whereas if someone just says something mean to me on Twitter, then I'm less inclined to believe them. I mean, sometimes you look at the motivations of people who are saying things to you, right? And sure. Try to judge whether, you know, this is criticism that's coming from a place that could be helpful or not.
But, like, I think about your book, which I read and I think is awesome. The paradox of your book and all books is that, like, the vast majority of agents and editors that saw it passed on it, like, by definition.
Oh, yeah.
Right? Like every project, even the ones that go into, like, a bidding war, there were still a bunch of people that were like, no, that's not good. That won't work. So it's this weird thing where, like, the people who are supposedly the experts on the thing that you're trying to do, you are having to defy a majority of them, and that all creative work that's successful had to defy that. It's like, if you think about it too much, it gets you back to that line from the screenwriter William Goldman, where it's basically just like, nobody knows anything.
Right. I mean, I can think of an example that, okay, so the first round of submissions with my book, I was with a different agent, and she had this kind of highfalutin vision for the book that we were going to go to a big imprint somewhere prestigious, and this was going to be a very literary title. And one of the things we heard, so all 16 of those folks that we approached rejected it. That was the first set of rejections. Anyway, one of the people who... Oh, amazing. It was good for my mental health. I don't want to say which press it is. Someone who is in a very powerful position over like a legacy set of books at Viking. said about my idea simply, that's not legitimate. It's not legitimate to see Poe as an existential hero. And I'm sorry, that's just ignorant. The French have seen him this way for 150 years. So in some cases, you're able to be impervious to it because you know that, I mean, it's historically inaccurate. Like that's right. That view has not been put forward in America necessarily, certainly not in a pop self-help book, but it's been around since Baudelaire was writing obituaries of Poe.
Right. Yeah, I think it's like, if this is just something that you pulled out of your ass and you're like, oh, that's what I think, and then everyone tells you you're wrong, you should probably stop and reconsider. But it's like when you've really done the work and it's based on something, I think then you can be a little bit more confident about it. And the thing I always think about is like, well, what am I trying to do? So when the person says like, oh, that won't work, or what about this? Or, you know, they give you all this, you're like, but are we trying to get to the same place? You know? And so sometimes the feedback, obviously rejections are a little bit different than feedback, but like when you really know what you're trying to do and you have a really good theory as to why you think it can work, you realize like a lot of the people who are rejecting you or giving you feedback, it's because they're holding you to a totally different standard and saying you're not going to meet that. And you're like, well, I wasn't trying to do that to begin with.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, one thing I ran into again and again was trying to articulate the degree to which the book is satire and yet serious. Mm-hmm. And I kept hitting people who were willing to see it as one or the other, but not both, which is funny because that's like the tension in Poe's own work. And maybe you just spend enough time with him and you pick up traits. But the thing about his stories is you can't often tell like how satirical he's being versus how serious he's being. But I like that tension. It keeps me coming back to him. It keeps me rereading him. Maybe it's not for everyone, but trying to file it in a single slot, you're just mistaking the whole enterprise. That was my take going into it.
I remember when I was writing my book Conspiracy, like my editor and I kept sort of going back and forth. And I finally had to go like, look, let's put all this aside. I'm going to tell you the book that I am going to write, right? Like this is what the book will be. This is what my goal is for it, right? So when you give me notes, they better get me closer to this thing or like I don't need them, right? And that can feel, I probably felt a little egotistical and I know it was like hard for me to get to a place where I felt confident enough saying that. But I was like, you know what? I've done this enough times. I know why I agreed to take on this project. And I also know, this is more humility, I won't be able to get there I'm having a hard time remembering the directions already. If somebody's shouting out conflicting or incorrect directions on top of that, I'm definitely going to get lost. So I think what sounds like you were trying to do is something that not a lot of people understood. And then you had to, when you're doing that, as Poe did as well, you have to remember what that is always, because the people who don't understand don't keep quiet about it. And then they sort of mess you up by going like, well, what about this? Or this isn't working, or it's too confusing. And you're like, I'm trying to do something that's a little contradictory by definition. So you pointing out that I contradict myself here or whatever, like that's a feature, not a bug.
Yeah. It's hard. I mean, I admire that stance in the face of the issue you were having with your editor. I haven't always been like clear in my resolve. I was when the final product was happening. Earlier, when we were more in the proposal stage, I was being swayed kind of by feedback that I was getting and trying to take it in various directions. And I think one reason it didn't sell and it didn't work is because it wasn't really true to my vision of the project. But it's hard to insist on that when it doesn't exist yet. I mean, in a sense, it's a tough creative brief to write. Yeah. I'm not saying that it's better for that reason, but it's a tough creative brief to write a self-help book based on someone who's famously perverse and a drunk and kind of a horrible person at moments.
And not but particularly think, successful.
No, certainly not in his lifetime, you know.
Right.
But I also think that that's precisely the meat of the project. That's where you start to hit gold, when you are turning over stones that folks maybe haven't, at least not in the U.S. I mean, the question of whether you can harness your perversity and make it work for you on some level, like, that's a question I want to hear more about. That's worth a book to me.
I've talked a lot about my morning routine here. One of the things I do every morning after I get up is I take a bunch of vitamins that my doctor recommended after some blood tests. I take a vitamin C, a zinc, a omega-3, and I take a couple others who I'm forgetting, but I definitely know whose vitamins I take. And they actually happen to be today's sponsor, and I've been taking them long before Thorn sponsored today's episode. Thorn takes a personalized, innovative, and scientific approach to health and wellness with all their supplements, and they've teamed up with leading medical professionals to bring out highly effective nutritional supplements. Because I'm a runner, I'm always trying to take care of my joints. And with Thorn, I never have to question what's in each supplement. Give your body what it really needs with Thorn. Go to thorn.fit/dailystoic and use code dailystoic for 10% off your first order. That's thorne.fit/dailystoic and use code dailystoic for 10% off your order. thorn.fit/dailystoic. Use code dailystoic. And note, these statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. Hims is changing men's healthcare by providing access to affordable sexual health treatments from the comfort of your couch. It's always sensitive talking about these things, but Hims is changing men's healthcare by providing access to doctor-trusted ED treatments such as chewable hard mints, brand name treatments like Viagra, or generic alternatives for up to 95% cheaper. The process is simple and 100% online. No uncomfortable doctor's visits. If prescribed, your medication ships to you for free. No insurance needed. Start your free online visit today at hims.com/TDS. That's hims.com/TDS for your personalized ED treatment options. Hard mints are a chewable compounded products which are not approved by or verified for safety or effectiveness by the FDA. Prescriptions require an online consultation with your healthcare provider who will determine if appropriate. Restrictions apply. See website for details and important safety information. Subscription required. Price varies based on product and subscription plan.
Yeah. Right. And look, like, I think there's also something about creative projects that maybe goes a little bit undiscussed, but like, there's a certain amount, like Stephen Pressfield believes in the muses, and I think Elizabeth Gilbert calls it the sort of the big magic or whatever. But there is kind of like a mystical like ness to it, where it's like, look, I didn't choose this. This is what came to me. I can't really do anything else. Like, you know, like it might be more commercially viable to do a takedown of Poe, or to do, you know, a total celebration of Poe or a different author, but like, this is the one that hit you over the head when you were walking down the street, and for better or for worse, you're stuck with it.
Yeah. I mean, sometimes the sheer amount of intellectual energy you feel in response to an idea is a really good gauge, not just of like the viability of the project altogether, but whether you can stick with it. And I mean, so I first experienced this in my own life, that Poe was cheering me up. And then I was trying to understand my reaction to why it was happening. And I was having trouble articulating it myself. And to kind of steer into that skid proved really useful. It's kind of like driving when you don't know exactly where you're going or how exactly you're going to get there. I don't know. That's so much more intriguing to me and such a more enjoyable process than not. Like, if it's paint by numbers, what's the point? Sure. At least for me.
Sure.
I don't know, so maybe you found it. Sorry, go on.
No, go ahead.
I was going to say, do you find that if you're given you're probably not often given assignments these days, but if you're given an assignment and someone says to execute on their idea, you just find it almost impossible, or at least not a joy to do? Whereas if you're executing on your own?
Yeah, of course. I mean, I think the whole point of the creative life is that you're trying to get to some kind of autonomy where you're sort of in control of what you do and say and think. And very few of us get there But like, if we were good at taking directions, we'd probably be textbook writers or, you know, advertising executives or something, right? Like, this is part of why we got into this is because we really can't do it any other way.
I definitely think that's true. It's kind of both the barrier to get permission to do those things is very tough. But then without it, where are you?
Well, that's one of the things I liked in the book is you sort of go into the idea that like, look, Poe's just like a freelancer grinding it out like the rest of us. And, you know, you see these, even like when you read Walter Isaacson's biography of Da Vinci, you're like, the greatest artist of all time is like being bossed around by these patrons. And it's like finding subtle ways to spite them or assert his independence. And he feels like he's underpaid and he feels like they're rushing him. You're just like, this is a very old journey that we're on. The like, I'm trying to make ends meet, do work that doesn't make me want to kill myself. And, you know, also survive.
And I think that's in a sense, like, I'm not glad that folks have suffered, not at all. It's not fair that they had such difficult lives, but also the fact that it is a very old struggle and maybe this has kind of always been the territory, I find that enormously comforting. It means you're not alone in it. It means you're not necessarily going about it the wrong way. Maybe this is just what it's like. And I also think that one of the lessons of Poe's life for me, and especially his freelance career, was that sometimes responding to the market or just simply getting information from the marketplace can be enormously valuable, whether you follow it or not, like whether you act on it in a straightforward way or you don't. It's this entire source of information and feedback that a lot of artists tend to ignore or try to ignore. Say if you're a trust funder, you can ignore it. But if you're a struggling freelancer like Poe was, you're not allowed to divorce yourself from the market and it ends up shaping you and you end up shaping it back.
But why are so many incredibly talented people, why do they seem to just generally be super bad at the politics and details and like logistics of their profession?
I mean, people are described as well-rounded on a fairly regular basis, but there are very few people I've ever met who truly are and who also have a kind of superpower, you know, where you have developed your craft to the level of like a Poe or a Melville. It puts you out of balance. The hours that you have to put in to be good, the kind of dedication and obsession that often goes into that to reach like a true genius level. And I'm not claiming at all to be there or near there, but having read a lot of literary biographies, you do kind of see what goes into it. And it's not at all characterized by well-rounded functional personalities or a lot of work-life balance. It's just not how the sausage gets made.
Yeah, like I wonder if you met like Fitzgerald or Poe or whatever, you'd just be like, come on, man, this isn't that hard. You know, like you just see, like historically, it feels like the decks were stacked against them or they had their demons or whatever. I wonder if you were like friends with them, like if you read some of like Hemingway's correspondence with Fitzgerald, he's just like, you can just feel him just like putting his hand over his face, just like so frustrated that his friend has all the talent in the world and just like keeps sabotaging himself.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not giving folks a pass for being nightmares, even if they're geniuses, but the rate at which people are also nightmares and also geniuses, like it tends to coincide and you do notice that without necessarily endorsing it.
Yeah, well, I think people go like, oh, Poe is a nightmare and a genius. Therefore, if I want to be a genius, I should be a nightmare. And it's like, first off, you know, there were a lot of nightmares who didn't become geniuses. But right. I think when you also, and this is what I like about your book, but also sort of hovers along the lives of all of these people, whether we're talking about a Kanye West or a Scott Fitzgerald, you're just sort of like, what work it cost them, you know? Like, if they weren't like grinding themselves into dust, making constant enemies, drinking themselves into oblivion or whatever, like, could there have been another Great Gatsby, or, you know, could there have been another The Raven? Like what work, in the way that, you know, Steve Jobs lost control of Apple and almost didn't get it back, right? Like the whole future of humanity would have turned out differently. Like it's kind of harrowing to think about like what got lost or left on the table with some of these talents.
Yeah, I mean, I think of Poe dying at 40 when in 1849 he was doing some of his most incredible work. I think that's the year, but Dream Within a Dream, it's Annabelle Lee, you know, some of the masterful, mature works where they function on so many levels. They suit a popular audience, they suit a critical audience. You could spend, you know, a decade with each of them. So if there had been more of those, that would be amazing. I have this recurring dream where I find Poe's journals. They don't actually exist, but I constantly imagine that I am going to discover more. But also, I don't know, the shape of his life now, it's hard to divorce what work we do have from the way things went, like the horrible death, the horrible loss and tragedy that went into it.
Well, so let's talk about that for people who don't know how does Poe go out? It's sort of almost fitting for a Poe story.
Yeah. I mean, people refer to it as like the greater mystery than anything he came up with in text. So the last year of his life is very troubled. His wife died in early 1847 and Poe kind of went off a cliff for a good year. And by the time 1849 rolled around, he's in these strange relationships with various women that aren't really, they're not sexual. They're bizarre romantic entanglements where no one's really available emotionally or otherwise. But he's in these and he's drinking a lot and he's leaving home and he never really did well when he was on the road. So anyway, it's a train of bizarre behavior that whole year. And then in early October, he leaves Richmond, where he's been hanging out with people who knew him in his youth. And the next thing we know, he shows up in Baltimore and he's found by someone who knows him. He's wearing someone else's clothes. He's in a ditch outside a tavern and he's not coherent. It's not clear that he was necessarily drunk at that stage. He definitely seems to be ill. And he never recovers consciousness to the point where he can explain what's happened to him, where he's been in the last few days, how he came to be wearing someone else's clothes, you know, what's wrong, essentially. And then he dies just a few days later. He died October 7th. And he was being cared for by doctors and nurses, but all of them changed their story so many times about what exactly seemed to be going on. Plus, it's hard to parse the 19th century science. So
they were basically quacks.
Right. I once asked a neuroscientist, like, what did brain fever mean in the 19th century? And he said it was applied to so many things that you couldn't possibly figure out what it might have been.
Right. Yeah. They were probably talking about bleeding him or, you know, like the tools at their disposal were probably preposterously bad.
Right. And to the degree to which people have read into bad information that we've got about the death, I mean, people have supposed it was rabies or gas poisoning or alcoholism or epilepsy, or, I mean, it kind of just goes on and on. People have assumed that he was in, like, it was called cooping, where people were they were made very drunk and then made to vote many times. There was an election going on about the time Poe collapsed. So that's one theory. Right? I don't know if I buy it, but I see how they got there.
What is your guess?
I think he was ill with some kind of disease that figured mentally and physically from the very beginning of 1849. I don't know what it was, but I don't think that it was necessarily induced by alcohol. I think kind of too much is made sometimes of post-drinking, which was more episodic than steady. I don't know that we can know either, it's not the most satisfying answer, but I also think it's better than supposing coming up with some bullshit and pasting it in the spot.
The less your business spends, the more margin you keep. I talk about that in Growth Hacker Marketing. But today, everything costs more. So smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, HR into one proven platform, helping you reduce IT costs, maintenance costs, and manual errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move to NetSuite.
Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/stoic. That's netsuite.com/stoic.
There's a lot of things we know would be good for us. Problem is, we don't have time. It's just tougher. I think therapy is like that. We all know that sitting down, talking to someone, really working on our issues will make a difference. So the problem is finding a therapist, driving across town, all of that, right? And that's where Talkspace comes in, today's sponsor. Because by doing everything online, Talkspace has made getting the help you want easier, more accessible, and more affordable. With Talkspace, you can sign up online and get a personalized match with a provider that's right for you, typically within 48 hours. You can have virtual sessions with your licensed therapist from the comfort of your home. And Talkspace is secure and private, using the latest end-to-end grade encryption to store client information and complying with the latest HIPAA regulations. As a listener of this podcast, you'll get $80 off your first month with Talkspace when you go to talkspace.com/stoic and enter code SPACE80. To match with a licensed therapist today, go to talkspace.com/stoic and enter promo code SPACE80, that's 80, to get $80 off your first month and show your support for the show. That's talkspace.com/stoic, promo code SPACE80.
That's my second favorite literary death story. My first is, do you know the story about who's a similar writer, sort of both brilliant, underappreciated, famous, not famous enough. Do you know about the death of Ambrose Bierce?
No, but I love him.
Oh, he's incredible. So Ambrose Bierce, again, similar thing towards the end of his life, although he lives to be much older, sort of becomes bitter and more bitter than he already was. Disillusioned, irrational. He sells all of his possessions. He goes through a tour of the southern United States, visiting all the Civil War battlefields that he fought on. Then he sends a letter to he tells people he's going to go meet Pancho Villa and write about it, who's like at the time sort of ravaging the southern border. And his like last known communication is a letter to his niece or his daughter-in-law or something like that, that basically just goes like, I don't know what's going to happen to me. I could get lost. I could get stood up against a wall and shot somewhere. Who knows? But if I make it, I'll let you know. And then that's the last he's communicated that anyone ever hears from him again. And from what I've read, significant evidence that he may have been captured and executed by Pancho Villa. So you have this sort of guy notorious for like twists and unexpected surprises in his short stories. Also stories about executions, accidentally or deliberately predicting his own death. And then no one ever finds the body or hears from him ever again.
That's an amazing story. It makes me worry that what you're into is a kind of destiny, which I hope isn't true for my own life. But I don't know, both Poe and Bierce seem to have this in common, in the sense of the death is emblematic of the work and the life.
I think so. I mean, I've read a lot more about Bierce than Poe, but one of the things that I heard about Bierce, I wonder if it applies to Poe. I'd be curious for your take. But they basically said, you know, you take these people who, like, I mean, Bierce's nickname is Bitter Bierce, right? They think he's this sort of bitter, disaffected, angry person, and that means he's like cynical and negative. And they said the people who knew him said it was actually the opposite. He was very idealistic, very hopeful, had very high standards for himself and other people. And it was the constant disappointment of these standards that eventually sort of drives him, not insane, but drives him down this dark place. So it's like it wasn't that he was cynical, it's that he had impossible expectations that were constantly going unmet that made him ultimately seem very cynical. And I wonder how much of that is a result of, I wonder how much that sort of sensitive thing that artists bring into the world, did Poe have that? Is that what made him drink and, you know, sort of go to this egotistical place, like as a form of self-protection?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely think that was one of the ways it functioned in his life. I mean, I think people often underestimate the role of initial earnestness and cynicism. I mean, Jonathan Swift was incredibly earnest, and he meant his satires in some senses. I mean, it was driven by his anger at the conditions in the world and finding it so far afield from what he thought it should be. I mean, how else would people get there? Of course, that's how they get there. With Poe specifically, I think, all right, trauma might be a word that we use too much now. But if you look at the specific timeline, especially of Poe's early childhood, so when he was between 2 and 3 years old, he likely witnessed his mother's decline and death from tuberculosis, which is a horrible drawn out death where you are gasping and gasping for air over a period of time, and then you essentially just drown in your own body. So for someone between 2 and 3 to witness this, who's already born sensitive, it's a time in child development where you're able to perceive so much more than you're able to say, because you're not really able to say much of anything. And then you have Poe's career, which is, he said, mournful and never-ending remembrance was his great subject. So mourning and grief. I don't think it's a coincidence that he had this early, almost pre-language experience. And then he spends his whole life articulating grief, you know, writing some of the greatest, they call it treaties, like The Raven and The Refrain of Nevermore. I don't think those things are unrelated.
Yeah, it's like once you have, like, you sort of read some of these things as a kid or as a creator, and then you have kids, and you're just like, no one should go through that. Of course that would screw you up so terribly. Right. How did you even get out of bed? Like, it's insane.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, I read all this child development theory. You know, I started the project before I had my own kid, but my little one's now 16 months old. And I can see it, I can observe it in him, that he is able to perceive and absorb and take on so much color that he's not able to articulate. And it makes me angry, frankly, at how often people underestimate children, especially very young children. You know, psychologists thought for 100 years that children couldn't grieve, which is so ludicrous to me. If anything, they're probably grieving harder because they don't have any precedent or, you know, adult balance to somehow address it within themselves, embrace themselves.
Yeah, or what's that idea that, like, I forget what the age, but you know what object impermanence is?
Right.
It's like, imagine if you didn't know where stuff disappeared, when stuff disappeared, where it went. You would be grieving constantly. Like, I thought about this to go to the point of, like, where some of the terror thing goes from. It's like, let's say you're 16 months, right? Not to freak you out about your son, but like, you put your son down for a nap or for bed. You're holding him, you're singing him to sleep. It's this peaceful, wonderful thing. You lay him down in the crib, you turn off the lights, they go to sleep, and then they just wake up. All their senses have been deprived. It's pitch black. They don't know that they were asleep. They don't know where the hell you went. They don't know if they're still alive. Or, like, they don't know anything. That would be the most ungodly, terrifying thing in the entire world. And we just, like, we just brush over it like it's nothing.
Yeah, the way we expect them to have some grip on things that they have no sense of. It's unreal. It's almost, I mean, in some cases, like, bordering on cruelty. I mean, particularly with... I don't know. I just don't think that we give them at all enough credit. I think they have way more self-control than they're allowed, you know, just in popular discourse or whatever.
Yeah. No, we go like, oh, this kid cries a lot. And then you're like, no, they should be crying. Like, if you think about how terrifying and uncertain and inexplicable life was, it's kind of impressive that they're not crying literally every second that they're awake.
Exactly. Exactly. So, I mean, I don't think we should give them shit about tantrums or, you know, occasionally screaming with something like night terrors. It's an awful thing to do. I mean, obviously there are limits of some sleepless parents' sympathy, but I think we ought to have more sympathy for them.
Well, I was thinking, it does seem like we should, with time, begin to go back, as we're sort of writing, sort of rewriting history with our better understanding of race and sort of this idea of white supremacy, it also seems like we should rewrite history with a better understanding of trauma as we begin to understand it. Like, I was thinking about this with Marcus Aurelius specifically. So Marcus Aurelius has like 11 children and eight of them died. Eight children. Like, if somebody lost one child and then they became an alcoholic, we'd be like, of course. Like, obviously we wouldn't excuse the alcoholism, but we'd be like, you became an alcoholic because you lost your child. That must have been very hard, right? Like there's almost nothing, like no life change or event that would not be explained or rationalized by the loss of a child, right? And then you're like, oh, he only lost eight children. He buried eight of his children. You're like, how did you wake up? Like, how did you get up, not give up entirely on other people in the world? And I mean, it's unfathomable, like, to think about the trauma that people went through not that long ago and just had to accept as a function of existence. And then of course we're also shocked they're like, they treated other people horribly. Imagine if you lost eight children, what that would do for your empathy or your, like, your ability to just give a shit about what anyone else is going through at any moment as you're walking through the world.
Right. I mean, I can't imagine the degree to which you would have to be like to become hardened even to survive. But one thing that occurs to me in it is the sheer awfulness of those things makes, at least to me, makes the achievements more impressive. Yes. Like for Poe, that he went on to articulate his grief in the way he did and these works that have survived time. Now, you know, 17 decades after his death. Or Marcus Aurelius, for that matter, that he went on to become this very effective and admirable leader. Wow, it's all the more an achievement because you've survived those things.
Yeah.
Or somehow managed to incorporate them in any kind of existence that is productive in any way.
Yeah, like, so people go like, what happened with Commodus, Marcus Aurelius' son? And it's like, maybe it was his dad and mom losing eight children. Or maybe it was just him losing eight brothers and sisters. Like, that would fuck a person up a little bit.
Yeah. I can't believe that anybody managed that. I really can't. I don't know that I have that kind of wherewithal at all. I mean, you know, you're a parent.
No, it's unfathomable to me. Like, it's unfathomable. I even think there's part of this, we're veering a little bit into political incorrect territory, but like we sometimes, like, we'll look at like slavery or some of the stuff, the terrible stuff of history, and we're like, you know, we judge like Thomas Jefferson like sort of very harshly, as we should, but we don't put it in the context, not of like everyone was doing it, but we don't put it in the context of like, okay, here's a fact about Thomas Jefferson. When Thomas Jefferson was president, someone gave him a pet goat, like as an official gift, and it was kept at the White House, and it just killed a kid. Like, a kid was walking around the White House grounds and just killed by a goat. And you're just like, oh, they just didn't value human life like much at all. Like, the world was just a cruel, awful place, you know? And so I think sometimes when we look at something and we try to understand how like a human could own another human, I think we sometimes miss what's staring us right in the face, which is that like, life was generally awful. And when people are themselves victims of a cruel, unjust, you know, difficult world, they also become victimizers. And I think, like, I think we sometimes lose the context of like what it must have. Like, you're like, oh, it could, for Poe, it could have been that he was just walking down the street and someone drugged him, beat him senseless, and then he died from it a few days later. Because that was a relatively common thing just like happening. And
yeah,
and we just like, that just recedes into the past as like a thing that wouldn't have colored his existence day to day.
Yeah, it's a question that I've, like, his perception of the cruelty, I mean, grotesque cruelty of his time, I've wondered about it. Like, you know from the book that one of his first jobs was in a building in Richmond that it was right by the slave market. So, like, couple scenes of, you know, family separation and so on. Like, the overseers at the lot did try to keep the drama out of it. Yeah, you would hear it. You would see it. Like, people being dragged around in chains. And Poe wrote so much about horror, you know, body horror, horror at the societal level too. He's more concerned with it than most people realize. And yet it doesn't appear. If it does, I mean, his treatment of race are not what we would hope they would be. And that's like, how do you miss those things? But I also think that we're like, often when we look at history, when we have no stake in it and it doesn't cost us anything, we're able to like kind of get on a moral high horse and be like, oh, I would have done things so differently. When people act like that about, it's a condescending attitude toward it. And I want to say, like, well, show me the moral stance that you're taking up right now that's really costing you something. Believe me, I'm not endorsing Poe's inability to recognize those things at all. It's horrifying, but people just treat it so easily.
Right. It's easy to be very glib about slavery as you sit there in clothes made in a Uyghur sweatshop in China that, you know, you could buy for 30% more that don't involve that, but you don't. Right. Like we sort of forget just the way in which we just accept what's happening in the world around us. Yeah. You walk down the street, you hear a slave market, and a human being can just become attuned to it. But I think what Poe does is clearly that affects him in some way, because it gets sort of channeled. The darkness gets channeled into the stories. And that's why they're so haunting and challenging.
Yeah, I think it's probably true. He wasn't a guy who was routinely cruel. People report that he was pretty polite and gentlemanly, and he seems to have cared for people. You can tell it in his letters. I think he loved his wife very deeply. He had friends that were very close. But I also say, like, kind of sympathy was a one-way street for him, kind of flowed toward him, maybe because of the awfulness of his childhood. Maybe he just couldn't kind of direct it elsewhere except at himself.
No, and I think when we understand the context of the world, it also, as you said, it allows you to appreciate the greatness. So, like, I think about Lincoln, and when you read about, like, Lincoln's childhood, just how, like, horrendously awful it was, right? And then you're like, and he still managed to, despite all that, you know, as a drunk father, as a loser, and this hardscrabble existence, is this ugly, gangly guy, all the stuff that he has against him. And then he still, I mean, he's not perfect, but he still does more than the people around him care about what's happening to these other people, right? And what, how, not just how rare that was, but that must have taken work, right? Because it would have been so easy to just be consumed with your own struggle and your own difficulties.
Right. And God knows it wasn't politically expedient for him to care about this thing. Sorry to work that agenda. I don't know. I know it's trendy or kind of against the grain, but I actually believe greatness is a thing. I don't know that it can be achieved, but it doesn't mean that we can't emulate it or try to, like the habits of people who do those things. I don't know. I think that, and you have to think that Lincoln was a bigger, stronger personality than the ones around him.
Well, look, it would be weird if you didn't believe in greatness for you to have written this book.
Right. I know it goes against the grain a little bit. Like we're kind of moving away from the like big man theory of history, which is, I'm not saying that's a bad thing. And yet I think
it's a terrible thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, of course. I mean, like, obviously it shouldn't be called the great man of history theory because, you know, history has been changed just as much by women. But it strikes me as a self-fulfilling prophecy. Like, if you don't believe that an individual can change the world, it certainly won't be changed by you. But, like,
yeah,
we look at, like, it's ironic. People, like, the same people who will go, like, oh, like, sort of be cynical and make fun of people who think that they can, like, change things for the better are also the people who are very indignant about the terrible things that bad people are doing. But it cuts both ways. Like, if a terrible person can change the world for the worse, why can't a good person change the world for the better?
Right. And if you want people to disrupt systems that are racist or whatever, you have to believe in the power of the individual to do those things. If individuals are disempowered, how do we create change? I mean, I know people talk about change at the systemic level. I'm certainly not opposed to that. But how does the system get changed?
I think that's totally right. And I think often, like, as a weird sort of minor political example, like, I think, like, people in Austin are like, we have a huge traffic infrastructure problem. So every time someone goes like, let's expand the freeway, they go, we don't need more freeways. We need systemic, you know, change. Like, and it's like, cool, but that's not going to happen. So you're actually choosing your sort of, your belief in the need for systemic change is actually preventing incremental change, which is only making it systemically worse. Right. And yes. So I think when people don't believe that an individual can make a difference or that minor, small term things matter, it feels like a self-fulfilling prophecy. But by your idealism, you are creating the seeds of your own cynicism, to go back to Beers.
Right. And I mean, it's not, I don't know, my own feelings are just more pragmatic than that. And it's also ahistorical to think that these things don't come about by a series of kind of shitty, imperfect compromises. Like any major change, that's how they happened.
Totally. Totally. And it's like, there are people alive who, like, there was just a guy who died. I'm forgetting his name, but there was one Democratic politician who personally, I think, proposed and passed two of three different constitutional amendments. And you're just like, oh yeah, that feels like it was a really long time ago, but it wasn't, you know? And that it's still like just one person changed the Constitution, this supposedly permanent document, like three times. And it's like, it's only because you're looking at it with a longer view that it seems possible, but it's when we zoom in, we go like, oh, an individual can't make a difference.
Right. And there were probably years of horse trading that went into any one of those changes.
Yes.
And it probably wasn't even executed in the form the guy hoped for in the beginning, because things just don't tend to be.
No, that's totally right. Or just that, like, I don't know, there's still people alive who met Winston Churchill. Like, there is an individual who changed the world. Like, not both you know, in positive ways if you live in America or England, you know, negative ways if you live in India or other countries, right? Like of course an individual can change the world. Like, it seems like all the evidence contradicts that assertion.
I agree. And I just add to you that, and of course that person is deeply flawed, right?
Yes.
Wasn't Churchill like a pretty sorry father, all things considered? This is true of too, like the genius was accompanied by some serious misbehavior as well. And a lot of attitudes that were not what we would hope they would be.
Totally. I'm trying to think, is there anything else people should know about Edgar Allan Poe or that you have learned in the course of writing this book?
That he's a hopeful figure. He's not at all, I mean, there's the kind of goth, dark side of Poe, but when you consider the tragedy of his life and the context of his accomplishment within the tragedy of his life, it's a tremendously hopeful story. I think it's actually quite positive. It's not our typical association with Poe, but I'm not the first person to read it this way. The French have for a while. Baudelaire wrote the book, seriously, 150 years ago. So it's not even new. Other people have realized this too.
Well, my favorite joke in your book is the idea that a writer can become so famous that they name an NFL franchise after you.
I mean, who can you say that of?
Nobody. And
the fact that, right, there's not a single other example. I can't think of anything even outside the NFL. Like, what other sports team in any line of has that sort of a connection to literature of all things? We think of these things as opposed, but the power of Poe imposing his personality on the world has shown that they can be related, which is amazing. I mean, that's greatness.
Although the Cleveland Browns are the only NFL team named after like a regular person.
Really? Should I know who Brown is?
Yeah, Paul Brown, like the founder of the team. He just named him after
I see. Oh, okay. Yeah, you know, when I talk about professional sports, I'm really wandering away from my area of expertise, such as it is. So
No, it is funny though. Until I read that in your book, I was like, yeah, of course, they're just named after the bird. But you're not like, oh no, Poe, Baltimore, like that. They didn't just pick the bird out of nowhere. It's like
right.
It came from something.
Yeah, this amazing poem about grief was written in 1845, and it's one of the few poems almost anyone knows.
Right. Yeah, no, just that there's a football team named after a poem, like, is pretty unreal as well. And I'm sure almost nobody knows that.
You wouldn't think it would happen in the U.S. of all places. We're not a nation that really values poetry, but I don't know. This is kind of the miracle of Poe, to my mind, that he has that kind of vast influence.
I think so. And he didn't live to see any of it, which is sort of the perfect Poe irony.
I don't know if he could have handled success any better than he handled unsuccess, though, to be honest with you. So
that is the perfect way to end this. Catherine, I love the book. I'm so glad we got connected, and we'll talk soon.
Thanks. This has been great, Ryan. Really enjoyed it.
Hey, it's Ryan. If you want to take your study of Stoicism to the next level, I want to invite you to join us over at Daily Stoic Life. We have daily conversations about the podcast episodes, about the daily email. We actually do a special weekend set of emails for everyone. You get all our Daily Stoic courses and challenges totally for free. That's hundreds of dollars of value every single year, including our New Year New You Challenge, which we're going to launch in January. You get a special cloth-bound edition of the best of meditations that we've done. You get a bunch of cool stuff. It's an awesome community. I've loved being a part of it. I've loved getting to meet everyone who's trying to take their study of Stoicism to the next level. Love to have you join us. Check us out at dailystoiclife.com. We'd love to have you and join us on this digital Stoa that we've staked out together and get better every day. Hey, Prime members, you can listen to The Daily Stoic early and ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen early and ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts.
Do you want to hear about the $100 wedding dress that just saved Abercrombie?
Or the tech acquisition that was just like Game of Thrones?
Or the one financial equation that can solve climate change?
Then check out our daily podcast, The Best One Yet, or as we call it,
T-Boy.
This is Nick.
This is Jack.
And we pick the three most interesting business news stories every day for the perfect mix.
20 minutes each morning, you're going to feel brighter.
We call it Pop Biz, don't we, Jack?
Where pop culture meets business news. So whether you want to kick off a conversation with your buddies,
or you're going for that promotion at work,
or you just want to know the trends before your friends,
feel brighter by starting your morning with us every weekday.
Listen to the best one yet on the Wondery app or wherever you get your pods.
You can listen to the best one yet ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. For more deep dive and daily business content, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts.
With shows like The Best One Yet, How I Built This, and many more, Wondery means business.
Guy Raz's How I Built This is a podcast where each week he talks to the founders behind the world's biggest companies to learn the real stories of how they built them. In each episode, you hear these entrepreneurs really go into their story. And Guy is an incredible interviewer. He doesn't just dance around the surface. He has real questions because he himself is an entrepreneur. He's built this huge show and this huge company. In a recent episode, they talked to the founder of Liquid Death, that crazy water company that's become this billion-dollar brand. Follow the show on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to How I Built This early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts. And for a deep dive in daily business content, listen to Wondery V. Destination for business podcasts with shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, The Best One Yet, Business Movers, and many more. Wondery means business.